today on Wings.
Some very important information about what we fiercely believe in and what we have to be doing in order to realize that vision.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The United Nations Commission on the Status of Women meets yearly in New York. NGOs, that is, non-governmental organizations, also gather there.
So welcome, everyone, this morning. This is our Civil Society Consultation Day, brought to you by the NGO Committee on the Status of Women New York. This is a committee which represents hundreds of member organizations and individuals from around the world who are working for the rights of women and girls. My name is Safira Rameshwar, and I am a representative of the Baha'i International Community to the United Nations and a secretary of the NGO Committee on the Status of Women New York.
You're hearing excerpts from a panel addressing the UN Commission on the Status of Women's 2019 priority theme.
It is my great pleasure to introduce our next panel, titled Social Protection, Definition, Context, and Vision. And our moderator is the Honorable Mary Lou McFedrin, who is the Canadian Senator, and her work revolves around human rights, gender equality, and Indigenous peoples. Please take your seats.
I'd like to acknowledge that we are meeting here on ancestral lands of Indigenous peoples who were here on the island of Manhattan before anyone else. The panel this morning has been organized along the theme of what we heard from our brilliant poets from Climbing Poetry. One line that really caught my attention was when they said that we are here for the world we have not yet seen, but we fiercely believe in. With an international development background, working with civil society in the Middle East and the North Africa region, Nadia Dar heads the Washington, D.C. office of Oxfam International. Since 2008, she has worked specifically on influencing international financial institutions to adopt policies and practices which promote inclusive, accountable, and sustainable development. Nadia, please.
Thank you for having me on this panel. So I'm here to talk about the context of rising inequality. Between 2017 and 2018, a new billionaire was created every 2 days. We're told that these are the people creating jobs for the rest of us, so their wealth benefits us all. But much of it is inherited wealth. And even when it is self-made, it is not actually self-made, but rather made on the backs of hardworking men and women and children. It is women who are spending 15 hours a day sewing clothes for a few cents an hour for global clothing brands, while the CEO of such a company will earn that woman's lifetime's earnings in just 4 days. Women who are peeling shrimp for our supermarkets, who get fired if they get pregnant. Women who are working in chicken factories and wearing diapers because they can't take toilet breaks. Let's remind ourselves that while pharmaceutical companies are hiding their multi-million dollar profits in overseas tax havens, the World Health Organization estimates that 100 million people globally are pushed into extreme poverty every year as a result of out-of-pocket healthcare expenditures. We find it somehow normal that while the biggest companies in the United States can spend over $350 million lobbying on tax issues, people across the world are threatened, jailed, and attacked for protesting pension reforms and other cuts to social spending, with women facing a particularly violent and misogynistic form. This trend of crackdowns on civil society fighting for economic and social rights is increasing and well documented from Latin America to West Africa. And by the way, that $350 million that I just told you about in terms of the lobbying, that resulted in $420 billion in tax breaks for those companies. Talk about value for money. The super rich are hiding away at least $7.6 trillion from the tax authorities, avoiding an estimated $200 billion in tax revenues. Kenya alone is losing $1.1 billion every year in tax exemptions for corporations. Meanwhile, the healthcare system is so underfunded and fee-based that many either can't get the medical help they need, or if they do, are detained in hospitals, not allowed to leave until they settle their medical bills, even if that person happens to be a postpartum mother grieving the loss of her babies who have died at birth. How did we get here? Not only are the rich and corporations not paying their fair share of tax, making governments lose out on the revenues needed to fund the basic services and the social protection we need and have the right to, they become richer, giving them even more political purchasing power. This inequality is making a mockery of our collective ambitions for human rights, and it is hurting women the hardest, who are overrepresented in precarious, informal, low-paid jobs and bear the brunt of unpaid care work, the unseen and too often forgotten machine that backs our entire global economy. But women's rights and gender equality will not be possible unless we address this economic model, which has resulted now in just 26 individuals owning as much wealth as the poorest half of humanity. Let me say that again. Our research found that last year, 26 individuals own as much as the bottom half of this entire globe. None of what I've told you today is normal. None of what I've told you is acceptable, but nor is it inevitable. Governments have the power to make different policy choices, to democratize decision making, to bring different people to the table, to bring women to the table, to be accountable to the entire population that they serve and not just the few. One of the most powerful things a government can do to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor is to provide universal, quality public services and universal social protection floors. Governments must make this political choice to build the revenues to do this through progressive taxation, and they must make the political choice to create gender-responsive budgets that provide services that work for women and the whole of society. Bilateral and multilateral donors and conveners should support countries in these efforts, and civil society should come together to demand these changes. Countries must also respect union rights, increase minimum wages, make women's rights at work comprehensive. Oxfam and Development Finance International's 2018 Commitment to Reducing Inequality Index shows that many countries are already taking steps in the right direction to tackle inequality. So let's not lose hope just yet, but let's keep the pressure on through forums such as these, because there is a long way to go. Thank you.
Nadja Daar from Oxfam.
Our next speaker will be Crystal Simeone, head of advocacy for FemNet in Kenya. Crystal's work has centered around fighting inequalities at a village level all the way to regional and global spaces and platforms, using a wide range of approaches to gender, macroeconomic issues, and illicit financial flows that as she says, keep her up at night. She has a passion for intersectional feminism and can be found discovering new hidden spots to do interesting things across Kenya in her spare time.
One of my favorite Pan-African feminists, Hope Chigudu, says, when I was young, I thought that life of equality, wisdom, and justice would be my birthright. If only I worked hard at school, excelled, got a good job and a good salary. I was wrong. Last month, a man in Kenya was arraigned in court for trying to steal his baby from the biggest referral hospital in Kenya because he couldn't pay a bill of $560. This is what we fight every day. The personal is political. I work for FemNet based in Nairobi in Kenya, but we have a membership of over 600 women's rights organizations and women's rights activists across 48 African countries. The work I do at FemNet revolves around the intersection of women's rights and macroeconomic policymaking. We find there's a lot of work on microeconomic issues, microfinance, financial inclusion, but really on the African continent, there's not very much going on that really looks at participation in a meaningful way, but also policy shifts towards including women and creating policies that make sense for the women and girls of Africa at a macro level. So I'll start also with a story from Lesotho. In 2015, the world gathered in Addis Ababa at the Financing for Development meeting. And basically, as Africans, we got told there isn't enough money for development, and so you need to look at other sources. Look at your domestic resource mobilization. Look at models that include public-private financing. And so this is exactly what Lesotho did. In 2007, the biggest hospital in their capital city was dilapidated, it was old, it wasn't providing solutions of healthcare that the population needed. And so the government of Lesotho went to the World Bank looking for what we were told to do, public-private financing. And that conversation turned into the idea to build a brand new hospital called the Queen Mamohato Memorial Hospital in Maseru, their capital. And the partnership was between the government of Lesotho and a private healthcare provider from South Africa, brokered by the World Bank. The World Bank, through the IFC, was supposed to give technical, legal assistance to, you know, for the government of Lesotho to understand how to create this partnership and negotiate the terms. The hospital was worth $100 billion, and it was set up. And then a year later, they found out that more than half of the budget of the country's health budget was being spent on servicing this hospital. More than half the country's budget. This hospital was in a capital city, not serving three quarters of the population of Lesotho who happened to be in rural areas. So this begins to tell a story of who's being locked out. The contract was also done under very shadowy terms, and so the public had no space to understand the contract, the negotiations, what was under it. And so the ballooning payments went up by 80% of what they had initially negotiated, and this was because there was a clause in the contract that allowed the consortium to charge per patient once the hospital reaches a set cap. And so once there were enough patients and it went over that, then they charged per patient, which then, you know, the costs just blew. So the World Bank and the IFC didn't provide the technical assistance to the government of Lesotho to be able to understand exactly what they're negotiating and be able to see what this clause would do. And as I said before, another critical area meant that there wasn't enough financing for rural hospitals outside of Maseru in Lesotho, and that puts three quarters of the population outside access to quality healthcare. The whole narrative and conversations around PPPs centered around the effectiveness of the PPPs and how they will come in and, you know, really ease in the way we do things and ease in service delivery. This also perpetuates the narrative that the African state is inherently and perpetually incapable and ineffective, and that private sector, which really is big foreign businesses driven by private sector interests, is a solution. And this means that there's a skew in what we prioritize as countries in terms of service delivery. If maternal healthcare isn't profitable, it's off the table. And that's not how our governments need to be thinking about our people and about our development. And so it brings me to my next point around data. And if you think about this in the backdrop of illicit financial flows, which Nadia brought up, Africa loses a minimum of $100 billion every single year through illicit financial flows. That's not a little bit of money. It can fund our own hospitals. We can fund our own schools. We can make sure that the man who is stealing his baby for $560 doesn't have to be arraigned in court for being able to get his baby out. We need to be thinking about data in different ways. We shouldn't just be thinking about sex disaggregated data, which is important, but we need to make sure that gendered data comes to the fore and begins to tell a story. Can we disaggregate by geographic location, by economic quintile, by age, so that we really know where the pressure is and where the real points of priority should be and what we should be financing? Another thing that we at FemNet bring to the fore is the idea that we need to push the idea of qualitative data and not just quantitative data. Our lives can no longer be relegated to just statistics. Our lived experiences and our realities should inform the policies that we make here in New York, that our governments make here in New York, and in our own countries and regions. And decisions need to be based on evidence. So a combination of both qualitative data as well as quantitative data, but also the right disaggregation of this data will begin to push us in the right direction. And finally, what we do at FemNet a lot of the time with regards to macroeconomic policymaking and influence is meaningful representation. I'll ask for my slide to go up. Every year in December, the first week of December, the African Development Bank, the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, and UNDP come together in what they call the African Economic Conference. It brings together activists, researchers, academics, you name it, from across the continent to discuss a theme on economic development in my continent. I went for one of the sessions, which was the only one that had a gender session. And I have a tool that tabulates who's taking ownership of a conversation, and this is it. Out of an hour and 20 minutes, women spoke for 5 minutes, and that woman was me. I asked a question and kept it going for 5 minutes. And so this figure needs to change. We're adamant we need to change it. And so we're putting money to make sure that we're financing research towards the next African Economic Conference, to make sure that we bring a delegation to the conference to destabilize. At FemNet, we believe we're not fighting for a space at the table of economic policies that are so skewed and so unjust and so unequal. What we're doing is we're being audacious enough to recreate models that work for everyone, to include everyone in these models. And so I will close with this. I believe in Africa. I believe in African dreamers like myself. I believe in the women of Africa, for they are the drivers of change for the next generation. I believe in the collective action of women and girls of Africa. And finally, I believe in the audacity of the women of Africa to change the destiny of our great continent, to ensure we all live in dignity and happiness. Thank you.
Crystal Simeone, Head of Advocacy, FemNet Africa. You are listening to Wings coverage of a panel on women and social protection systems around the world. Moderator Marilou McFedrin.
Our last speaker is Dr. Corina Rodriguez-Enriquez from the Dawn Executive Committee based in Argentina. A feminist economist, Corina works as a researcher at the National Council of Scientific and Technical Research and the Interdisciplinary Center for the Study of Public Policy. She is also a member of the Latin American Gender and Macroeconomic Group, a board member of the International Association for Feminist Economics, and her working areas include social and fiscal policy, care economy, labor market, poverty, and income distribution. Corina.
So I want to add my 2 cents talking about the Latin American context, where countries have developed different paths of social protection systems. Mostly the ones in the southern cone have reached extended levels of what we can call welfare states, while others, such as the countries in Central America, present narrower and weaker social institutions and therefore worse social indicators. However, there are some features that are common in the region. A high level of informal economy, persistent fiscal constraints, high level of poverty and inequality, clear intersectionalities, race, ethnical background, age, gender, of course, and a traditional sexual division of labor that results in gender bias in the labor market as well as in access to social protection. During the last 20 years, there has been quite a bit of progress in social protection systems in Latin America. First, consolidation of a human rights approach to social protection. Second, a kind of renewed legitimacy of the state intervention that also allow for increasing in public spending, increasing investment in education, extension of coverage of social benefits, mostly cash transfers, and I would say embryonary or initial discussion on care issues. In the last long decade, conditional cash transfers programs have been in Latin America extended widely, focused on poor households with children, transferring basic or minimum income to mothers if they do comply with children's school attendance and health controls. For many of them, this is the first time that women are recognized by the state and are subject of public policy. The cash transfers has been important to improve living conditions for women and their families. And they have, to some extent, strengthened women's economic autonomy. However, there is a bit of a controversy from a feminist perspective, especially regarding their conditionalities, because they reinforce women's care roles, making it more difficult to transform the traditional social division of labor. And they might keep women away from the labor market, increasing poor women's dependency on the state and weakening women's autonomy in the long run. And the debate also is there on how we can move from conditional to non-conditional cash transfers in the region. The other strategy to extend cash transfers has been through reforms in the pension systems. That one, extend the coverage, and second, guarantee minimum income for older people. Countries in the region have reached this goal either through the establishment of universal pensions, as it is the case in Bolivia, or in the city of Mexico, or through the integration of non-contributory elements in the more traditional contributory pension systems, as it is the case in Argentina, the country where I came from, or in Chile. These reforms have also had a relevant impact on women, since the women are the most excluded from labor markets and therefore for contributory pension systems. For example, in Argentina, 75% of the 2 million people who gain access to the pension benefit through this mechanism were women. The positive impact of these transformations in terms of improvement of women's lives is undeniable, though limited due to benefits being too low, at risk of losing its real value in inflationary context, as well as counter reforms that start to restrict access. Finally, a piece of good news in Latin America is that governments have started to pay attention to the growing demand on care issues, recognizing unpaid care work, as well as assuming some responsibility in provisioning, in care delivery. The national care system in Uruguay is the most solid example because of its integral approach as well as its progressive implementation connected to the social protection systems. And I want to finish by bringing two main worries and one big hope. The first worry, from a Latin American perspective. The adverse economic situation and therefore a stronger scenario of fiscal constraints. We cannot think, and this has been already mentioned, about how to improve social protection system or build social protection floors without taking into account how to secure financing. And in this conversation, I think we are also facing some very tricky and risky conversation with the private sector, and this has already been put into the table. As Crystal mentioned for the case in Africa, I think we should to take into account that public-private partnerships should be meant for people and not for corporations' profits, or not for feeding the financial sector. We need to think and promote progressive tax system reforms, international tax cooperation, and approaching the big issue of illicit financial flows. There is no way to argue that it is impossible to finance social protection floors when 26 people in the world hold as much wealth as half of the population. We need to take this money to fund what the institutions of social protection floors. My second worry, in the region, the political shift. A new wave of right-wing governments with a return of economic policies driven by neoliberal paradigms or market regulation paradigms, plus conservative or even, I would say, fascist political stance are a big threat, not only to improve social protection system, but also to protect what we have just gained. But we have, in my point of view, one big hope, and this is feminism. Women and feminist organizations. I think women, we are the hope. Feminism in Latin America is the most vibrant social movement at the moment. Last Friday's International Women's Strike was a very solid example of how involved and how mobilized and how organized women are. Women's movement is the reserve of resistance and the seed for social change. We are the reserve of the public goods and the collective alternative. So these coming days are a great opportunity to discuss how we can move forward to the construction of this resistance and new alternatives. Thank you.
Corina Rodriguez Enriquez, feminist economist from Argentina, speaking to women from non-governmental organizations on March 10, 2019. The event was organized by NGO CSW New York around the proceedings of the UN Commission on the Status of Women. A fourth panelist was Vinicius Pinheiro from the International Labor Organization. He elaborated a distinction between rights-based and needs-based approaches to social protection and urged inclusion of both in UN agreements. For more audio from this event, contact wings@wings.org. Special thanks to IAWRT USA, your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. You can listen to other Wings programs at wingsradio.org and visit our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.